Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. The issue I will deal with in my lecture is devoted to the changes which intervened on the eastern border of Italy and on the consequences which such changes had on the general situation of the nation. But first of all, let me thank Philippe de Marat and the University Paris II for this invitation, which I feel much honored for. As a result of the demise of the continental empires, the end of the First World War saw the drawing up of numerous new boundaries in Europe, designed to set apart states which, with the only exception of Bolshevik Russia, claimed to be grounded on the principle of nationality. Italy, as one of the victorious powers, was able to extend her sovereignty to the ex-Austrian provinces of South Tyrol and the Littoral, thus fulfilling her aim of national unity by including all the significant Italian-speaking populations inside the border of the state, and gaining a strategic boundary that is a boundary relatively easy to defend from a geographical point of view. A quarter of a century later, at the end of the Second World War, Italy lost almost all the territories to the east, which she had gained from Austria to her Yugoslavian neighbor. The port town of Trieste was to be transformed into a free territory under the guarantee of the United Nations. The region beyond Trieste became Yugoslavian with the peace treaty in February 1947. It is safe to say, then, that Italy, which had existed as a state since 1861 and was based on the principle of nationality, had only been saturated from a national point of view for 20 years. In this speech, I will address the problem which factors prevent the Italian state from maintaining the border drawn up with the Treaty of Rapallo between Italy and Yugoslavia in 1920. That is, why did Italy lose the territory gained after World War I, after World War II? After the outbreak of the First World War, Italy declared her neutrality, since, as an ally of the Central Powers and in accordance with the Triple Alliance, the duty to intervene existed only in the case of a defensive war. But a few months later, the Italian government began secret negotiations with the Entente to participate in the war on their side in exchange for significant territorial gains. With the secret Pact of London in April 1915, in exchange for her participation in the war, the Entente promised Italy the territories of South Tyrol, the Austrian littoral, a large part of the Dalmatian coast, Valona in Albania, the acknowledgement of her possession of the Dodecanese island, a sphere of influence in Asia Minor, and the share of the German colonies. Contrary to the expectations of the Italians, at the end of the war, the government was confronted with the daunting prospect of having to justify its principal territorial claims, not from a defeated Habsburg monarchy, but from the new victorious kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. In addition, for the main protagonist of the peace conference, the American President Woodrow Wilson, the Pact of London represented the epitome of that hated secret diplomacy, according to which people were handed over from one state to another without any consideration of their own wishes and based only on cynical calculations of power. Already in the ninth of his famous 14 points, Wilson had foreseen for Italy boundaries corresponding to clear ethnic lines, which meant rather less than what had been promised with the Pact of London. Woodrow Wilson permanently opposed the claims of Italy to a significant amount of Dalmatia, where Italians represented only a very small minority, and the majority of the population was composed of Croats and Serbs. Speaking of the Italian-Serbian controversy, Georges Clemenceau had occasion to comment contemptuously, quoted, "My God, Serbia or Italy, the blonde or the brunette," which testifies to the scarce consideration in which the Pact of London and her beneficiary were held in Paris. Wilson also vehemently opposed Italy's claim to the port town of Fiume, Rijeka, in Croatia, whose national council repeatedly expresses the wish to become part of Italy, a claim never contemplated in the Pact of London. For Fiume, Wilson favored transformation into a free state. A new situation came into being in 1920, when Woodrow Wilson was defeated at the presidential elections and the USSR refused to enter the League of Nations. Since the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes had lost the most prominent supporter, not bound by the Pact of London, it was consequently ready to reach a compromise with Italy. In Italy too, the politician who had been the most energetic supporter of the Pact of London, the ex-foreign minister Silvio Sonnino, had left political scene. At the time of the French negotiations, the Prime Minister of Italy were firstly the moderate and democratic-minded southern Italian Francesco Saverio Nitti, followed from the 11th June 1920 onwards by the elderly liberal Giovanni Giolitti, representative of the Piedmontese elite and arguably the most experienced politician in Italy. Foreign ministers were Tommaso Tittoni and later Count Carlo Sforza, an enlightened nobleman with undisguised sympathies for the South Slavs. On the other side of the table, the main negotiator was the Croatian Ante Trumbic, one of the most prominent members of the Yugoslav Committee and one of the architects of the Yugoslavian state. The negotiations led to the Treaty of Rapallo in November 1920, which could have represented an honorable compromise between the conflicting claims. Count Sforza asserted that the boundary established in Rapallo, which together with the previously signed Treaty of Saint-Germain with Austria granted Italy a line of defense along the Julian Alps, meant full military freedom and a permanent safety for the eastern territories. That is, it was a strategic boundary. According to the foreign minister, not even at the time of the Roman Empire had Italy had such a perfect borderline. Italy gave up nearly all her claims to Dalmatia, retaining only the Italian stronghold of Zara. Nevertheless, she did obtain even this strategic border at Mount Nevoso to the east and at the Brenner to the north. In this way, Italy came to include inside her boundaries 350,000 German-speaking citizens, 300,000 Slovenes, and 100,000 Croats. Also, many of the diplomats who attended the Paris Peace Conference shared Wilson's opinion that Italy's claims were excessive and wildly unjustified, This judgment should be questioned and put into its proper historical context. Italy's aims in stipulating the Pact of London had been twofold. First, to gain full control of the Adriatic Sea, thereby replacing Austria-Hungary as the dominant power in the area. And secondly, to achieve a stable and acknowledged position as a great power. Later events would prove that Wilson was all too right in his skepticism about Italy deserving great power status. In spite of this, however, such aims were understandable at the end of a victorious war, which had cost Italy the loss of 600,000 soldiers. It should be also borne in mind that although Italy's claims were considered imperialistic and unreasonable, much more extensive demands were met in the case of Romania, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, who were granted unquestionable possession of territories inhabited by millions of Hungarians, Ukrainians, Germans, and White Russians. As the American-Hungarian historian István Gyér has correctly pointed out, the right of self-determination was recognized in Versailles only for the victors and the successor states of Austria-Hungary. Italy was unlucky enough to have to put her claims to a victorious state, and one which in addition enjoyed widespread sympathy and support. The failed implementation of the Pact of London and the risk that few men would go to Yugoslavia led to a wave of nationalistic demonstrations throughout Italy. The poet soldier Gabriele D'Annunzio drew a picture of a mutilated victory just as potent as metaphor for mobilization as the step in the back in the defeated Germany. The occupied territory on the eastern border became a hotbed of fascist squads, conspirators, and adventurers. In September 1919, D'Annunzio and a few thousand legionaries, many of them rebel officers and soldiers, occupied Fiume in order to protest against the failure to assign the port town to Italy. The government was powerless, and the number of the legionaries rose to 10,000. Radical rightists in Rome toyed with the idea of a putsch. Such events contributed to the fall of Prime Minister Francesco Nitti in May 1920, on the anniversary of Italy's entry into war, violent demonstrations were organized in Rome, leaving several people dead, both on the side of the demonstrators and of the police. In order to gain control of the disorders, Nitti ordered that all citizens from Fiume and Dalmatia should be arrested. This draconian measure met with an extremely critical press campaign on the side of the nationalists, and Nitti's position was seriously weakened. Only a short time after, the government was beaten in a vote about increasing the price of bread, and Nitti was forced to resign. He was substituted by Giovanni Giolitti, who, as mentioned above, found himself in charge of undersigning the Treaty of Rapallo with Yugoslavia. Despite being neglected by historiography, there is quite a strong link between the disorders in the occupied territories and the rise of fascism, at least in the discrediting of parliamentarism, in the broad aspiration to a strong authoritarian state, and in the widespread illegal behavior of officers and soldiers, which was to be observed in the border areas. At the peak of the Fiume adventure, the military commissar extraordinary in charge of Julian Venetia, General Pietro Badoglio, reported to the Prime Minister that he was no longer in a position to answer for discipline in the army, nor could it prevent officers and soldiers from joining D'Annunzio. Even the admiral in charge of the military occupation of Dalmatia joined the insurgents. None of these acts of mutiny had any consequences, and no mutineer was punished. According to the historian Roberto Vivarelli, the Fiume adventure was the cradle of the Italian anti-state. The American historian Denison Brusilov remarked that even after the Danunzian adventure, after the end of the Danunzian adventure, he quoted, the potions it had generated continued to do their work on the Italian body politic, unquoted. After the March of Rome, fascist Italy was rapidly able to revise the Treaty of Rapallo to her favor through the Treaty of Rome in 1924, and to share the free state of Fiume between herself and Yugoslavia. It is interesting to note that while Mussolini visited the territories on Italy's eastern border several times before his power sharing deal in October 1922, many years were to pass before he was to return. He remarked once that Italian policy should rise above the insidious and sterile ground of the Adriatic question. Only in September 1938, by which time fascist Italy had shown clear signs of convergence with Nazi Germany, did the Duce visit Trieste again, where he announced the implementation of the ominous racial laws before an enthusiastic cheering crowd. During almost 20 years of fascist rule, Mussolini adopted an active, though somewhat erratic, foreign policy and was able to claim some sound diplomatic successes. Signs of the new fascist activism in foreign relations, sometimes also enforced with military means, were the occupation of Corfu after an incident at the Greek-Albanian border, the support for the Austrian Republic against Nazi Germany in 1934, with the demonstrative sending of divisions to the Brenner Pass, the Conference of Stresa in 1935, and the negotiation at the 1938 Munich Conference on the issue of the Sudets. Fascist military activism, coupled with imperialistic expansionism, led to the invasion of Abyssinia in 1935. The aggression ended with the conquest of Abyssinia and the proclamation of the Italian Empire. The victorious war in Abyssinia filled most Italians with pride. On the whole, it appeared that Italy had achieved the long-cherished aspiration of becoming a great power. It quickly became clear how illusory this impression was in the course of the Second World War, when Italy was crushingly defeated on all fronts and the poor equipment and lack of fighting morale of the Italian soldiers became evident. Fascist Italy's policy towards Yugoslavia was erratic. After sharing the free territory of Fiume, time seemed ripe for a policy of good neighborhood between both countries, which had no more serious dispute to settle. In 1925, they also drew up the Nettuno Conventions, which envisaged far-reaching cooperation at various levels. But the implementation of the agreements was hampered by the lobbies of Julian and Dalmatian hardliners in Rome, and by corresponding pressure groups in Belgrade. The Yugoslav government was accused of having sold off national interests, and mass demonstrations against the agreement were organized in Zagreb and in Belgrade. The Treaty of Rome was not extended to comprehensive economic cooperation, and Italy switched to a course of destabilizing the Yugoslav statehood, encouraging Macedonian and Croat separatism, and even offering refuge to the Ustashas Ustasha terrorist movement. Tensions between Italy and Yugoslavia were exacerbated by the assimilation policy which Italy imposed on the Slovenian and Croat minorities. It was no coincidence that this policy escalated after 1925, when it became clear that the Ventura conventions were doomed to failure. Slovenian and Croatian were gradually prohibited as languages of instruction and for official use, and by 1929, most newspapers, associations, courts, and so on, had been dissolved. Some 10,000 Slavs emigrated to Yugoslavia, where they began a very lively irredentist program with associations, newspapers, and underground activities. Terrorist acts were committed in Julian Venetia too. Not surprisingly, this activity escalated after 1926, given the failure of the Ventura conventions. In conclusion, the ethnic tensions in the border area and the claims of minority representatives and of Slovenian and Croat nationals created a major obstacle to rapprochement between Italy and Yugoslavia. Mussolini was very impressed by the successes of Hitler's revisionist policy. He was acutely aware of the fact that an expansion of Germany in direction south and southeast would endanger newly acquired Italian possessions in South Tyrol and in Julian Venetia. And in order to deal with this possibility, he tried a second rapprochement with Yugoslavia in 1937. The Italian Foreign Minister Galeazzo Ciano and the fascist-friendly Yugoslav Prime Minister Milan Stojadinovic signed a treaty of friendship which was supposed to bring some relief to the oppressed Slav minority in Italy. The treaty was intended to dissuade against German aspirations toward the border regions, once that the expected Anschluss of Austria was complete. The treaty signed in Belgrade in March 1937 came as a great surprise to world opinion. During the following months, relations between the two countries showed visible signs of improvement with the setting up of an Italo-Yugoslav cultural society, of student and cultural exchanges, and of courtesy visits by warships. Yugoslav dissatisfaction with Italy mostly regarded the failed improvement in the treatment of the Slav minorities. Apparently, the goodwill of the fascist government in Rome was hampered by obstructionism on the part of the prefects in the border provinces, mostly outspoken nationalists and veterans of the nationality struggles in the old Austrian empires. Once again, dynamics in the border zones undermined more notable initiatives planned at the center. As it is widely known, Mussolini was so impressed by the visit in Berlin in September 1937, that he put all his hopes in Nazi Germany. He was convinced, and not wrongly, that an effective revisionist policy would only be possible by being on the side of Nazi Germany. Elated by the prospects of taking advantage of the new unmixing of territories and power relations, he played down the risks to continue possession of the ex-Austrian provinces. In 1941, following the putsch by Serbian officers against the signing of the Three Powers Pact by the King of Yugoslavia and the consequent attack by Germany, as an ally of the Third Reich, Italy occupied large areas of Yugoslavia, the province of Ljubljana, Dalmatia, Montenegro, and Kosovo, which was annexed to Albania, also temporarily under Italian rule. Such apparent successes could not conceal the fact that from the autumn of 1940 onwards, after the failed Greek campaign, Italy was just another German satellite. In October 1941, Galeazzo Ciano, who was not only foreign minister but also Mussolini's son-in-law, wrote down the following remarks by Mussolini in his diary. Quote, "Even if they," said Mussolini, "even if they, the Germans, asked for Trieste to be included in the German vital space, we would have to comply." Unquote. The territorial expansion of fascist Italy lasted only a short time. In September 1943, after the armistice was signed with the Allies, the Italian army was left without orders and broke ranks on all fronts. The armistice signed on 18th September corresponded to unconditional surrender. The Italian Kingdom of the South continued the war with the feeble forces of the remaining army on the side of the Allies as co-belligerent. As much of the country was occupied by the Wehrmacht, and as Mussolini had placed himself at the head of a republic which collaborated with the Germans, Italy became the stage for a bloody civil war, and the dreams of being a great power were shattered once and for all. At the end of the war, after a bitter confrontation between the Yugoslav and the British troops about the subdivisions of occupation zones, Yugoslavia got nearly all of the territory Italy had gained in Rapallo through the Paris Peace Conference. Accordingly to the peace treaty, the port town of Trieste was to become a free territory guaranteed by the United Nations. As the Cold War made any agreement about the implementation of the free territory impossible, in 1954 the territory was shared between Italy and Socialist Yugoslavia. Trieste became Italian for the second time. Unlike after the First World War, when Italy could defend her interests as a victorious power, this time the Italian government had hardly any say in decisions regarding the new territorial settlement. Initially, the Cold War probably favored defeated Italy, which would otherwise, without the Cold War, most likely have lost Trieste as well. After the expansion of Yugoslavia from the international communist network Cominform in 1948, the Western Allies were interested in settling the dispute between Italy and Yugoslavia because they hoped to include Yugoslavia strategically in the Western Bloc. The 1954 partition was recognized officially by Italy and Yugoslavia only in 1975 with the Treaty of Osimo. In the 80s, at the time when the relations between Italy and Yugoslavia seemed to be developing positively, the Yugoslav state entered its final critical phase. In this place, the republics of Slovenia, the republics of Slovenia and Croatia came into being. In 1991, along the Italian border. In recent years, the border area has been involved in the process of the enlargement of the European Union eastwards. In 2007, Slovenia entered the Schengen area, and the border between Italy and Slovenia was correspondingly weakened. On the other side, the border between Slovenia and Croatia, just a few kilometers farther on, now mark the boundary between the European Union and non-European Union space. I am coming to the conclusions. How can we put this example in a broader context. The extremely intricate events in the territories on the northeastern border, which Italy inherited from Austria-Hungary in 1920, together with the instability and frequent change of sovereignty which characterized this area, are features partly shared with other border regions in Central Eastern Europe. In fact, in border regions such as the one along the Yugoslav-Hungarian border, in the frontier territories between the Soviet Union and Romania, and in the territories which Hungary ceded to Romania, violent nationalistic and ideological clashes represented a common legacy of the multinational empires, additionally exacerbated by the radicalization of political cultures as a consequence of the First World War and of the Bolshevik Revolution. Such clashes played a significant role in the outbreak of the Second World War and in the building of an alliance of revisionist states around Nazi Germany. The struggles of the Italian Yugoslav border were just one example of territorial conflicts between states and the local groups referring to them, characterized by the aim to fill the contending space exclusively with their own people, language, meanings, and symbols. In other words, to saturate the space from a national point of view. The exclusiveness and comprehensiveness of this claim helps to explain the level of violence and of intransigence which were displayed in such clashes. From the perspective of 20th century Italian history, the acquisition of the ex-Austrian territories was closely related to the aspirations of the political elites to make Italy a European great power. This was the logic which permeated the clauses of the Pact of London, with the preeminent aim of obtaining an unchallenged position of dominance in the Adriatic. The collapse of Austria-Hungary and the building of the new kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes made this aim illusory, and later events would give further proof of the hopelessness of this plan. As the British diplomat Harold Nicholson noted at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, quoted, "Italy was determined to become a great power without the internal force to justify such an ambition," unquote. The nationalistic fever, which affected a great number of Italians at the end of the First World War, and the disillusion felt by the mutilated victory, certainly favored the coming to power of fascism. Whereas the state of political anarchy which reigned in the occupied territories, especially in Fiume under the poet soldier Gabriele D'Annunzio, until the signing of the Treaty of Rapallo, clearly showed the weakness of state authority and the limited control Italy had even over her own occupation troops. Even after diplomatic relations between Italy and Yugoslavia were normalized, the Adriatic periphery was able to obstruct policies devised at the center. Repeated attempts to bring about an easing off in relations between Rome and Belgrade were frustrated by the nationalists on both sides of the border. Finally, in the border region, Italy inherits those well-established political cultures developed in the last decades of the Habsburg monarchy. A main feature of these were conflicting nationalism, struggling for dominance at the local level and attempting to gain support from different political centers, Rome and Belgrade, Zagreb or Ljubljana, respectively. The dynamics between political elites at the center and at the periphery gave origin to peculiar political phenomena as frontier fascism, characterized by the virulent Italian nationalism with anti-Slavic target, or on the other side, to a communist movement where anti-Italian feelings had a prominent place. To sum up, Italy proved herself unable to integrate the border region satisfactorily into the structures of the national state. Even in the fascist era, control over Julian Venetia remained precarious, and the region retained its own specific political culture, borrowed from the Austrian period and radicalized under the influence of war and revolution. The prominent anti-fascist exile Gaetano Salvemini stated on one occasion that Italy could not refrain from accomplishing her national unity once the circumstances were favorable. As a matter of fact, the attempt to fulfill this national aspiration almost immediately cast a pitiless light upon the shortcomings of Italian institutions, shortcomings which could only be partially concealed by the fascist idolatry of the state. The enormous disparity between the firm belief of Italian nationalists that completion of national unity would bring acknowledgement of Italy as a great power, and the modest resources the Italian state actually made available to accomplish this goal, helped to explain the rapid withdrawal of the border in the course of the Second World War. Until now, this inconsistency has been neglected in modern Italian historiography. And as a consequence, the issue of the northeastern border and its instability has failed to be placed into its proper historical frame. Many thanks for
listening. Merci beaucoup, Marina. Si Jean-Jacques veut bien venir à